Chapter 7. It's not as bad as it could be. They cross the desert in a loose circle, staying quiet to preserve moisture. Styles can practically feel the salt eating away at his lips. They're cracking by the time they've gone through an hour of the desert. Danny is the official timekeeper, elected because he has the nicest watch. Every hour he calls time, and they sit down for 5 minutes. Considering some of their previous misadventures, like climbing a mountain in Fairy, it's not terrible. He's thirsty almost constantly, but the exercise itself is low impact and boring as hell. His entire body aches from the crash, but he's dealt with worse, and soldiers on. Around noon, Erica says, "Should we take a break? Hottest part of the day, you know." "Actually, that's a common misconception," Lydia says. "Noon is when the sun is highest in the sky, but not the hottest part of the day. The Earth needs time to absorb that heat and then reflect it back into the sky. Typically, the hottest part of the day is mid-afternoon, anywhere between 2 and 6 p.m., depending on the time of year. It's autumn now, so probably 3 to 5-ish. "God, I love having a walking encyclopedia with me," Styles says. Lydia gives a haughty sniff. "I am getting pretty hungry, though." At this, Lydia nods. "Okay, let's take 15 and have a small snack." A small snack from Lydia is half a sandwich each. She carefully peels one of the oranges and divides it up into sixths. Styles is much more interested in the moisture from the orange than he is in the turkey sandwich, but he eats all of it. They fan themselves for a few minutes and start walking again. He's drawn into his inner thoughts, thinking about everything that's happened so far, and decides he'd like to talk about it without using up any of his actual voice. "Peter?" he calls out mentally, and a bare moment later the werewolf appears, walking next to him in the desert. "What have you gotten yourself into now?" Peter asks. "Kind of a long story," Styles replies, without using his physical voice, and then starts to explain. He spares no detail, knowing that even the smallest thing could be important. Peter listens in silence, grimacing when Styles explains Phil's role and what had been done to Chris Argent, and then huffing out an incredulous breath when Styles gets to the plane crash. "Only you," Peter says. "But in reality, you're lucky."
"This is lucky?"
Styles asks, glancing around at their surroundings. "Considering the alternative, you could all be dead, for one thing. You could have been stupid enough to try your luck with the parachute. But alternatively, they could have hijacked your plane and taken it wherever they liked. You could be imprisoned right now. So yes, Styles, I would say that this was a fairly lucky outcome." Styles sighs and pushes his hand through his hair.
"Okay, thanks for putting that in perspective."
"I did try to warn you that your enemy would only grow more bold with time," Peter points out.
"Yeah, now really isn't the time for I told you so," Styles says, annoyed. "Let's not forget something. We're dealing with two enemies. You were talking about the General Hunter War, not whichever Moriarty is trying to ruin my life."
"True," Peter says. "And this does have the fingerprints of our Moriarty all over it. The same method, using someone less intelligent as a pawn to enact their scheme. I don't know that you would have gotten anything out of Henry Argent in any case. Although, it would certainly beat being stuck in the desert. What's bothering you, then?"
"I don't know. This was just more ruthless than before. I could have died. For real."
Peter gives him an incredulous look. "You really are becoming inured to the constant turmoil in your life," he says. "You could have easily died when Eli had his hands on you. For real, as you put it. Jackson intervened in a way that nobody foresaw. You could have easily died when Deucalion was in town, and you certainly could have died when our Moriarty framed you for the murder of the Alpha Pack hunters. I don't see how this
is any more or less brutal. No, you're right. It's the wrong word. Styles chews on his lower lip. It was impersonal. It left so much to luck, rather than skill or cunning.
Peter considers this. Yes, all right, I do see your point. But many people believe that luck is its own kind of skill. And you do have the devil's luck, Styles.
I just can't help but wonder, Styles says. Chris was pretty adamant that he didn't think Jim Stoddard was likely. Whoever's doing this honestly seems to be in it for the fun rather than any real desire to kill me. It would have been so easy to just shoot me during that whole thing with Eli. It's a game, and that's not Stoddard. But at the same time, it's like every new piece of the puzzle links back to them.
Perhaps he's being subtle because he doesn't want to be caught, Peter suggests. Using others, staying out of the game directly. He's afraid of the consequences if he takes a direct shot at you. You do, after all, have powerful friends.
Yeah, maybe. I just still feel like I'm missing something.
Well, you are, Peter says. You're probably missing many things, but all the pieces will come together in time. And this is one more piece of the puzzle. It has to have been someone who was in California. Things happened very quickly, did they not? You were on that plane less than 24 hours after Chris came to your den and tried to kill you.
Barely more than 12, Styles agrees.
Stoddard wouldn't have had time to get all the way here from New England, even if he found out what had happened right away, Peter says. Though I suppose it's possible he could have hired his dirty work done. Still, it's a lot to accomplish in 12 hours. Finding out who your pilot was, what aircraft they used, finding a way to disable him and the plane. Impressive work.
Huh. Maybe we can find out where he was at the time. You know, presuming we ever get out of the desert.
You will, Peter says. I can't find it in me to believe that you've survived so much only to die of dehydration in Utah.
Thanks for that. Styles chews on all of this for a moment. It would have been easy for them to find out. Phil was still in contact with his parents. They would have told Moriarty that things had gone downhill.
Would they? Peter asks. The way Phil talks about them, they seem intimidated. Given their overall level of pride, it seems more likely to me that they would have hidden the truth from Moriarty and tried to salvage the situation themselves. What did they know?
Let's see, Styles says. Phil couldn't text them from inside the panic room because of the jammer Chris was using, and we took his phone away right after that. So, he probably told them that Chris had attacked, but then...
Radio silence, Peter says. And you took his phone?
Yeah, while we were still in the armory.
Peter considers this. So they don't even know what happened. They might assume their son is dead or a prisoner. Do you have those phone records with you?
What? Yeah, Danny probably does. What do you need to know?
If Henry Argent and Moriarty spoke after what happened at the den, Peter says, which one of them called who and how long they spoke?
Okay. Styles clears his throat and opens his mouth. Hey, Danny, you got those phone records that you looked up for Henry Argent?
They're on my laptop. Why?
Danny asks, glancing over at Styles. Peter and I are theorizing, Styles says, and tells Danny what they need to know. Lydia declares a 5-minute break. Everyone gets a sip of water while Danny looks the information up.
Okay, so what happened at the den was after dinner yesterday, around 7 p.m., Danny says. And our mysterious mastermind called Henry about 7:30 local time, which would have been 9:30 in Illinois. They talked for about half an hour.
Huh, Styles says. So, Moriarty called right away. We were in the armory for about 20 minutes, maybe. Moriarty knew things had gone wrong, and he called Henry to discuss their next step.
That's a pretty long call, so Henry argued, which probably means he wanted to come here and handle it himself, and Moriarty told him to step off. Derek looks up, and Stiles can tell he's thinking about the timing, the same way Peter had. Moriarty was in California. He was watching us. Yeah, that's the inescapable conclusion, Stiles says. That would explain why he was able to sabotage the plane with only a few hours of notice. Given his personality, I think this actually makes sense. Like Sebastian Stone, it wouldn't be fun to play with us from halfway across the country. He would want a front row seat to the chaos. And come to think of it, the sorcerer would have to be nearby too. Only incredibly powerful sorcerers can cast over any sort of distance. Deaton himself seems to be limited to about 100-mile radius. You know what else bothers me? Lydia says as they start walking again. Who is the sorcerer? From the way Deaton described the magic that was done, it doesn't sound like it was easy. They must have someone relatively skilled and powerful, distance aside. Yeah, Stiles says. I don't know. Hunters don't usually deal with people who practice black magic. Well, Derek says, clearly they decided to bend the rules. Stiles nods, and the group falls into an uneasy silence as the sun rises higher in the sky. Victoria talks to Chris for what seems like hours, telling him about what's happened in Beacon Hills. She tells him about Allison meeting Scott, this time gifting Scott with her laser stare anytime it looks like he might get excited about the fact that Victoria is presenting his relationship with Allison as a good thing. She tells him over and over again. They talk about other things in between sometimes. Other stories of things that happened during Stiles' years as the Alpha that are less relevant than the main events. They let Mac tell him about what happened to Neptune and how frightened she was, but how Stiles made her feel like she would be all right. Isaac tells him about how they helped him get free of his father, and how Stiles was adamant to solve Roger Leahy's murder, even though he hadn't been a good man, because he knew Isaac wanted that. After a couple hours, Chris nods off again, leaning against Victoria's shoulder. Victoria looks at Allison and says, I was up all night, so if you don't mind. No, you get some rest, Allison says. We'll keep watch. Allison nods and closes her eyes. Scott squeezes Allison's shoulder and says, He's going to be all right, Allison. Your dad is amazing. Allison manages a smile and says, Yeah, you're right. You guys don't have to stay. Are you crazy? Of course we're staying, Isaac says, and Mac nods. Let's just be glad it's a Saturday and Deaton doesn't have any patients to see. Anyway, he's got a computer in his office. Maybe we could watch a movie or something? Good idea, Scott says. They leave the door to the main clinic open so they can keep an ear out. It takes Scott a minute, but he manages to get Hulu streaming on Deaton's computer. They sit down to watch some television. Allison promptly falls asleep, curled in Scott's arms. Nobody bothers her. It's about 1:30 when she hears her mother's phone ringing in the other room. It wakes her up. It apparently wakes Victoria up, too, because a moment later she hears her mother answer it. Hello? Yes, how are you? I see. You're sure? No. Give me 10 minutes. She hangs up the phone and says, Allison? What is it? Allison asks, heading into the clinic with the others on her heels. Her father is stirring as well. That was Julian, Victoria says. He says Stiles and the others aren't at the airport. He was going to pick them up there, but their plane never landed. What do you mean their plane never landed? Scott demands. Somehow Victoria manages not to retort. It really only has one meaning. Instead, she replies, calmly and evenly, I'm going to call the person who chartered the flight for us and see if I can find out what happened. Allison has already whipped her phone out and called Stiles. It goes directly to voicemail without even ringing.
Stilinski voicemail. You leave it. I'll retrieve it.
Styles' cheery voice says. She hangs up without leaving a message and tries Derek. Same response, albeit without the cute rhyme. She tries every member of the pack in turn and gets the same thing. No ringing, just straight to voicemail. Their phones are either turned off or don't have service, she reports. Jesus, Isaac says, his eyes wide. With nothing else to do, they sit in silence and listen to Victoria. Even Chris is listening, but it's not much of a conversation.
Yes, yes, Franklin McDonough. Yes, a twin otter DHC-6300. I'm sorry, I don't know the call sign. Yes, I'll hold.
There was a long silence.
Yes, I'm here. I see. Was there any radio contact?
All right.
Thank you. Yes, I appreciate that. Do you have my number?
Thank you. She hangs up and sees everyone's gaze fixed on her. The transponder for Franklin's plane shows it never left Beacon Hills, she says. They contacted the airport. It turns out that the transponder was removed from the plane and stowed in the hangar.
So the plane could be anywhere, Scott says, going pale.
Air traffic control confirms that the plane did take off as scheduled without incident, Victoria continues. But without the transponder, there's no way of knowing where it went afterwards. There was no radio contact after takeoff, but that's not unusual. If there was no problem that the pilot was aware of, or that air traffic control was aware of, there was no reason for him to be in communication with anyone.
Obviously, there was a problem at some point, Isaac says anxiously.
Yes, but there are a lot of reasons it might not have been called in. If the radio failed, or if someone on the plane was preventing him from using it.
Like if the plane was hijacked, Max says. Her voice is somewhat flat. Because that's a thing that happens in our lives.
Victoria grimaces a little. It's possible. Either way, I think we had better call Sheriff Stilinski. Sheriff Stilinski's reaction is almost identical to Scott's. He demands, "What do you mean they never landed?" And Victoria gives a brief summary of what they know so far. Tom listens and then says, "I'll be there in 10 minutes," and hangs up without a word. He's alone when he gets to the clinic. "Where are Jake and Phil?" Victoria asks him.
"At my house. Melissa is with them. The security system is armed. What do we know?"
Victoria explains in more detail. The plane had taken off. The transponder had been removed. And somewhere between Beacon Hills and Peoria, it had simply dropped off the face of the map. None of the pack members who were on the plane are answering their phones, and they can't locate the phones by GPS either. "There are two options," she says. "Either it went somewhere else, or it crashed." Tom paces around the clinic.
"How well do you know this Franklin guy?"
"We've flown with him several times before," Victoria says. "We've never had a problem." "Is it possible he could have been bribed or extorted to fly the plane somewhere other than Peoria?"
"Certainly. Anything's possible." "Okay, let me get his bank statements and his phone records. What's the FAA doing?"
"They're sending out some helicopters to fly through the flight plan at a low altitude and see if they can spot anything," Victoria says. Tom nods and paces around for a few minutes. The pack members are watching him anxiously.
"Okay, if they crashed, there isn't anything we can do, at least not now. We'll have to rely on the people at the FAA to take a look. But if they were hijacked, that's another story. They could have taken them anywhere. Maybe we can figure out where."
Victoria grimaces slightly. "A plane that size could easily land at almost any airstrip. They wouldn't even necessarily need an airstrip if the area was open enough."
"Jesus," Tom says. "How the hell can we find out? There are dozens of options."
Isaac raises his hand and says hesitantly, "Maybe we can ask?" Everyone turns and blinks at him.
"Beg pardon?"
"We have their phone number," Isaac says.
I mean, not just to Henry Argent, but whoever he was taking orders from. Danny got it from his phone records, so maybe we should just call up the number and see who picks up and ask where they've taken Styles. There's a round of incredulous looks. Could that possibly work? Allison asks. Isaac shrugs. I don't know. I just know that Styles is always talking about how the third option, like he calls it, is sometimes the simple thing that nobody thinks of. Like when the Alpha Pack hunters tried to kill us and he just called the police. Like when he was being framed, he decided to turn himself in and explain that he was innocent. I guess I don't see how it would hurt, Tom says. I mean, other than giving away the fact that Styles is missing, and we know that, which whoever this is probably already knows anyway. I mean, I doubt that he'll just give us all the answers, but maybe we can get something out of him. Victoria, why don't you call Julian and have him go talk to Henry and Rose? See what they know.
Okay, Victoria says, taking her phone back out and stepping away. Tom gets on the phone to get the records he needs for Franklin, and after some debate, Allison decides to call the number for their mystery adversary. But the results are disappointing. It rings 6 times and then goes to a generic voicemail message, the kind supplied by the phone itself. She leaves a message saying, "This is Allison Argent, and I would like to speak with you as soon as possible."
That was anticlimactic, Isaac says glumly, disappointed that his idea didn't have a better yield.
Well, we can't just sit around, Scott says. I'll call Dr. Deaton. Maybe he'll have some ideas.
He gets on the phone as well. It takes a minute to explain the situation, and the druid says he can certainly try to locate the pack magically, though he cautions them not to get their hopes up. This is standard operating procedure for Deaton, and it doesn't bother them. He arrives about 15 minutes later, about the same time that Sheriff Stilinski has gotten an email with a bunch of phone and bank records. Mac and Isaac sit down with that, while Allison stays with her parents and Scott goes to help Deaton. Deaton has a locked safe in his basement, which he opens to reveal a variety of tools and artifacts. The one he draws out is a small mannequin that's magically connected to Styles. It's the beneficial voodoo doll that he had made in the past. They've never figured out how to work up any sort of alarm system so it will automatically trigger at any injury, but he can still use it as a voodoo doll in the regular fashion. He also takes out a rolled-up map, spreading it over his work table. Scott sits in silence, ready to assist if Deaton asks, but not wanting to interrupt. Deaton puts the voodoo doll on a string, which unfortunately gives it the appearance of a hanged man, and Scott has to hold back a shudder. It begins to sway back and forth over the map gently, moving in a concentric circle until it goes still. They've needed enough locator spells at this point that Scott knows what that means.
No reaction?
Deaton nods and opens his eyes.
No, they're most likely out of my range.
He considers for a minute.
If we can't locate them other ways, I think the best thing to do would be for me to drive along the flight plan, stop every 50 miles and try again. It will be time-consuming, but if they actually crashed, that would be the easiest way to find them.
Okay. Yeah, Scott says, nodding. Good idea. Especially since none of us want to get on a plane right now, he adds, wincing. He pauses as a thought occurs to him. Can you use magic to track down whoever did this to Chris? Maybe we could find the sorcerer that way?
If he or she has an ounce of sense, they will be shielded themselves, Deaton says. But it's certainly worth a try.
He climbs the ladder out of his basement workshop and tells the others their conclusions. Tom is still going through bank records with a fine-tooth comb, and he barely looks up.
Chris, if you would supply me with one of your hairs, I can try to find the sorcerer who did this to you.
Chris frowns and shakes his head. No. No, I can't do that. Not after everything. It's not safe.
Victoria comes over and squeezes his forearm gently. It's fine, Chris. We trust Dr. Deaton. but sorcery. It's fine, she repeats. Chris, trust me, remember?
Chris lets out a shaky breath. Okay, but only if I can watch what you do with it, and we destroy it right afterwards.
Certainly, Deaton says. He gestures for Chris to join them in the lab, and Victoria follows along. They've been gone about 10 minutes, and Scott is pacing around when Victoria's cell phone rings. Allison runs over and grabs it, since Victoria is downstairs and they don't want to disturb Deaton. But she doesn't want whoever's calling not to talk to her, so she picks it up with, "This is Victoria!" Everyone watches as her face grows pale. The werewolves in the room stiffen.
I see. Okay. Oh, really? Okay. That's good. Uh-huh. Okay. Thanks.
She hangs up, and Tom immediately demands, "What is it?"
"They found the plane."
Allison's hands are white-knuckling the back of the chair her father had been sitting in.
"In northern Utah. The official said that, from the look, it had been a crash landing. She said it was mostly intact. They found one body. The pilot's. Nobody else's."
"Why would Stiles have left the wreck?" Isaac asks. "He knows that's his best chance of being found."
"Yes, he does. And not necessarily by the good guys," Tom says grimly. "Their plane was clearly sabotaged. He probably suspected that whoever did that would be able to find him a lot faster than we can. So he went to try to find shelter, or a way to call home. It was a smart move, even if it doesn't help us. Or there's the possibility that they didn't leave voluntarily, that whoever crashed the plane picked them up from the crash site."
"If we can get Deaton to the wreckage ASAP, then he can try the locator spell again," Scott says.
"Jesus, we can't just put him on a plane," Max says, laughing a little hysterically. "And that's gotta be a full day's drive."
"Then we'd better get moving," Allison says.
"Do we really want to divide up again?" Isaac asks. "I mean, we're leaving the territory practically unprotected. What if this is what they wanted?"
Tom pushes a hand back through his hair. "You're right, but I don't see what we can do about it."
"We need backup," Allison says. "We should call Justin."
"Oh, Jesus," Scott says. "Tell Cora that her brothers disappeared into the Utah wilderness after a plane crash? That's gonna be a fun phone call."
"If it'll get them here, let's do it," Tom says. And then they all look at each other. Tom closes his eyes for a few moments, but manages to speak evenly.
"Does anybody have Justin or Cora's phone number?"
"Only Stiles ever calls Justin, and only Derek ever calls Cora," Isaac says helplessly.
"Derek Skypes with Cora, but it's always from Stiles' laptop, which he brought with him."
"Then we'll just have to be extra vigilant," Allison decides. "Scott, why don't you go with Deaton? The rest of us will stay here."
Everyone agrees with that. The others come up from the workshop a few minutes later, and Allison tells them what happened in their absence. Deaton agrees to pack a few things and goes back down into the basement. Victoria is looking pensively into the distance, and after a few moments, she says,
"There's one other thing we can do. If the enemies have indeed gotten hold of Stiles and the others, the most likely place for them to be is the Nazario prison in Wyoming. It's secure, already prepared to hold supernatural creatures. I don't know exactly where it is, but it probably isn't too far from northern Utah. It would be much, much easier to transport them there than to try to get them all the way to Stoddard's prison, or to prepare a secondary location."
She stood up and smoothed down her skirt.
"I think it's time I called my Aunt Vanessa to see what she has to say about this."
Jake isn't really interested when he hears Melissa answer her phone downstairs, but he keeps half an ear out anyway. Phil is curled up on Stiles' bed, trying to watch television. She brought them each a tuna salad sandwich and some chips about an hour previous. He likes Melissa.
She's always been nice to him.
Hey, honey, Melissa says, which means that it's either Scott or Sheriff Selinsky calling her. Then, abrupt and alarmed,
oh my God, are you sure? What happened? Is Scott with you?
She adds, which answers the question of who she's talking to, but not what they're talking about. Phil looks anxious now, too, responding to her tone of voice, even though he doesn't know her.
Okay, yes, of course, I'll stay with them.
Uh-huh. No, it's already set. I haven't been out since you left this morning. Just keep me posted, okay?
Okay, love you.
Jake practically falls down the stairs with Phil on his heels.
What is it? What's happened?
He asks, seeing that Melissa's naturally tanned skin is paler than usual. Melissa looks up at them, and, seeing Phil, tries to find a gentle way to phrase things.
Styles and the others haven't been in contact, she says. We are not sure where they are.
They were going to go see my parents, right? Phil asks, eyes wide.
Do you think my parents did something to them?
No, Melissa says slowly. They didn't make it to Illinois.
Didn't make it? Jake asks. What happened?
We don't know, Jake, Melissa says, keeping her voice calm and even. All we know so far is that the plane left at 8 a.m. on time and never landed in Illinois. We don't know if it crashed or if it went somewhere else instead. Tom and Victoria are going to see if they can find out what happened, and they asked me to stay here with you. Can you double-check the alarm system for me?
Yeah,
Jake says. He takes Phil by the elbow and heads to the front door. He sees Melissa heading into Tom's office, which means she's going for the spare gun in the safe. All of the parents in Beacon Hills had taken a crash course in how not to be a liability for your werewolf child, which had included self-defense lessons and firearm handling by Chris Argent. Jake checks the alarm system and makes sure all the windows are closed and locked. He knows how to handle a gun, too, but he doesn't really have any interest in doing so, and he's pretty sure that Sheriff Selinsky only keeps one spare in the house. Then he calls Allison.
Is there anything I can do to help? He asks.
Not right now, she says. She's calm, but clearly shaken. Uncle Julian is going to go talk to your parents. We are waiting to hear back from some other people, too.
Okay, Jake says. Just, if there's anything,
I'll let you know, Allison says. Jake winds up prancing around the house while Melissa and Phil sit at the kitchen table. Melissa is trying to get Phil to play cards with her, but he's tense and distracted. When the phone rings, they all jump. Melissa grabs it.
What is it?
She asks, and then closes her eyes for a few minutes.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I love you, sweetheart. Be careful.
She hangs up and takes a deep breath. The plane definitely crashed, she says, but they didn't find any bodies. So either Stiles and the others are trying to hike to safety, or they were taken from the wreckage. Right now, Scott is going with Dr. Deaton to see if they can find them using a locator spell. Meanwhile, we're still waiting to hear back from your Uncle Julian, and Victoria is calling her Aunt Vanessa up in Wyoming to see if she knows anything about it.
Okay, Jake says. He's frightened, but handling it. If the bodies weren't in the wreckage, that means that Stiles and the others are still alive, and nobody can handle weird, dangerous situations like Stiles and the pack.
Deal me in, okay? Maybe we should make some tea. Melissa nods, but she's looking at Phil.
Are you okay, honey?
This is all my fault, Phil says, and chokes back a sob. Everyone here was so nice to me, and I probably got Stiles killed. He never did anything to me, and I got him killed.
Oh, no, honey. None of this is your fault, Melissa says, moving over to his side of the table to get an arm around him. For one thing, don't count Stiles out yet. You'd be surprised what he can survive. But nobody thinks this is your fault. Your parents lied to you, and that isn't your fault.
But it is, though, Phil says. I mean, they told me things, but Jake and Uncle Julian told me different things. But I didn't listen. I just believed everything my parents said to me, even though I should have known they were wrong.
They're your parents, Melissa says firmly. You had every reason to believe them. And I know that it's really hard for you to hear this, but they manipulated you. They knew what they were doing when they lied to you.
She gives him a hug and says, if you can't believe that it's not your fault, can you at least believe that nobody here blames you? Phil sniffles. I guess I can try.
I'll take it, Melissa says. Forget tea. I think you need some cocoa. How about it, Jake?
Sure, Jake says with a wan smile. He reaches over and tussles his brother's hair. I'll be right back, okay? He adds and jogs upstairs. Tom had given him Phil's phone with the instructions to go through it and catalog everything that Phil had told Henry. He hesitates for a minute, then taps the screen to call his father's number. It rings 6 times, but then goes to voicemail. He tries his mother, but gets the same response. After pacing around for a minute, he calls Julian on his own phone. Uncle Julian, it's Jake. Did you get in touch with my parents?
No, Julian says. His voice is cautious, carefully measured. They're not here.
Jake swallows.
Did they make a run for it?
I'm not sure, Jake, Julian says. Their cars are still here, but they might have had some other method of transportation available. I'm going to see what I can find out, okay?
Okay, Jake says, and hangs up.
He stares out the window and wonders why he's so sure that his parents are dead.